And we welcome you to another edition of Gateway to Baseball Heaven, the first postseason, or the off-season, I guess, edition of Gateway, as we didn't meet last week. I am Daniel Shoptoff, C70 at the bat, at C70 on Twitter. With me, as always, is Tara Wellman from Birds on the Black, and at Tara Wellman on Twitter. And Tara, World Series is going on. The Astros have come back from this 2-0 gap and now look like that Astros team we thought they were going to be when the postseason started. Is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Does it really matter? What are your thoughts on the World Series so far?
This is the World Series matchup that I was hoping for if the Cardinals were not involved. So that
there you go.
Fine. I was really, really hoping that the Nationals would just go right ahead and sweep the Astros out of the postseason, because I would have felt a lot better about the Cardinals' performance if the best in baseball Astros were also manhandled by the Washington Nationals. That is not proven to be the case, but not really surprisingly. I mean, this Astros team hasn't been as good as they have been all season, like by accident, right? And they have proven that they can lose some games and come back and win. I don't know what their longest winning streak is, but that they can come back and win some games when they look like they're down and out as well. They went out and got significantly better at the trade deadline, like they have done in the past. And so did the Nationals. They went out and bolstered their bullpen at the trade deadline. And surprise, it's weird to see, but evidently that works and gives you a little bit of a boost when you head down the stretch. But look, the Nationals were, I don't know, I think one of the best teams in baseball after their 19-31 start, and the Astros were pretty much good all along, and then they got even better. So it's not surprising to see these two teams here. It wasn't surprising to me to see the Nationals jump out to a 2-game lead. I feel like a lot of people were undervaluing what they did, maybe in light of how pathetic the Cardinals looked in the NLCS, but this is a Nationals team that has kind of been right there and really capable all along. It was sort of startling that they started the way that they did, and they've got the pitching to really carry them pretty far, and they've got some guys who are quite capable on the offensive side as well. So it's fun in that light. I haven't gotten to watch all of the games of the series so far, but you know, there's something to be said about the World Series going as many games as possible for people who aren't emotionally invested and turning it into an exciting series. So the pitching matchups have been great to see. There've been some huge offensive performances as well. And I guess when you're not particularly invested, that's what you hope for in the World Series, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I guess if you're just watching it for the baseball, you want a game seven that's tight and dramatic. And, you know, to do that, you got to have the other team, both teams win some games. You know, and right now, at least you're going to a game six back in Houston at worst. Could be a game seven as well. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's been a fairly good series, even though a couple of the games kind of got out of hand late. Ironically, one of those was not because they got into the Nationals bullpen, which is the kind of that thing that we thought we continued to think during the LCS, if we could just get into that Nationals bullpen. But you have to get hits off the starters first, from what I understand. And who would have guessed? Yeah, it would have been nice. I think it would have made you feel a little bit better about the Cardinals' performance if the Nationals had continued on. But still, they're the team that finished second in the National League. They're the National League runners up. If the Nationals are not able to fulfill their duties as NL champions, then of course, obviously, the Cardinals get to take on those. Whatever, isn't that the way the beauty contests work? Let's talk a little bit about that series. So, you know, we didn't get a chance to really finish it up. And I know you and Alex talked about it on Chirps, and Alan and I have talked about it on Mutual, but it just was not really the way you wanted to see this season end. I think it was not necessarily surprising that Washington was a better team, but I don't think we ever expected it to be quite so dominating.
Yeah, when Alex and I did talk about it, it was actually the night of that last game for the Cardinals. And that's just it. I mean, it felt like, particularly after maybe game one, certainly after game two, that the Astros were the better team. at that point in the season. But I mean, look, we'd seen the Cardinals offense go pretty ice cold multiple times in 2019. So that wasn't necessarily surprising. I think it was a little bit startling to see it happen so dramatically, particularly coming off of that 10-run first inning in Atlanta and, you know, kind of riding that high a little bit to then, you know, just see, yes, good Nationals pitching do what it's supposed to do, but also the Cardinals lineup do what it had done at some really unfortunate times earlier in the year, and that is just look completely baffled by anything that isn't a fastball. And that's a bad time. Bad time for that to happen is in the NLCS. So, yeah, not necessarily surprised that they got beat at that point of the postseason. In fact, I've said multiple times, they made it further than I expected them to this season. And that's great. And that's fun and bonus and extra and whatever. But once they're in it, you kind of want to see them at least play well. And they just really didn't. It was, we're focused on the offense because that's the biggest offender here. No, I didn't really mean to the offense, you know, what, yeah, right. Whatever. But there was some really uncharacteristic defensive miscues in that series as well that I felt like sapped some of the confidence from this team. And whether that translated or carried over to their at-bats, I don't know. It didn't necessarily coincide at other times in the season, but it certainly didn't help, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, if they make some of those plays, especially – you know, at the game four, if they make up, you know, some of those plays that they have made all year long in that first inning, you know, they get out of it with, you know, one or two runs scored, and instead it's a big 7-run thing. And the Cardinals still, I mean, it's sad that the last half of game four was like the most fight we saw out of them in the whole series.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had a chance with Carpenter up and the bases loaded to, you know, if nothing else, you know, tie the game, maybe even take the lead. And that's, you know, for the fact they started out 7-0 out down, that's pretty impressive. It's just that you didn't see much more of that throughout the season, or throughout the series. And yeah, there really wasn't much more to do than just to tip your hat. I mean, it was remarkable to see them that bad after beating Scherzer and Strasburg just a couple of weeks before that. It wasn't like, you know, oh, they beat the Nationals back when the Nationals were struggling, which they did, but they'd also beaten them just right before the season was over when the Nationals were playing, you know, some of their better ball. So you at least thought it'd be a, you know, competitive series. Just disappointing. And I don't know. Do you think then that the front office looks at this team and says, hey, they made it to the NLCS. All we need to do is one little thing here and there. Or did they look at it and say, this team was fortunate to get to the NLCS and didn't really show up when they got there? There may be more of an issue, more some underlying things we need to take care of.
You know, even though there are a couple of things, I think if they look at how the NL Central shook out and the fact that the Cardinals needed the Rockies to win two games in the last week in order to hold on to what became a very, very small lead when the Brewers appeared to be out of it. I mean, that should shake them a little bit just to say, okay, how can we secure this a little more so that we're not depending on the Rockies to beat the Brewers in the final week of the season? The other thing is, I don't know that they would say that this team was fortunate to make it to the NLCS because we've talked about it before. I know I've talked about it with Alex. They had to really scratch and claw for everything that they got this year because of guys that were underperforming or because they didn't get any help at the deadline or because in many ways, Mike Schilt had to pull a lot of correct strings along the way just to get them to that point. So I don't know that I would say that they were fortunate to get there because they certainly earned that chance. But the way that they went out just with an absolute whimper, I think should be very telling about this team's ability to compete with the best in baseball. I think there's a little, I don't know how significant it is. It feels pretty significant when you look at that. There's a gap between competing for the NL Central and competing for the World Series. And I think the front office has to decide what's good enough. I mean, if winning the NL Central and then kind of pressing your luck and seeing what happens in the postseason is acceptable, then you probably don't need to make that many changes, because you would assume that some guys who underperformed, which is like everybody but Colton Wong and maybe Jack Flaherty, will at least come up to normal next year and even out a bit, and then you'll be right back in the same position, capable of competing for the division. If that's enough, then no, you don't need to go out and do anything dramatic. But if you need to be able to compete with the likes of the Nationals and the Astros and the Yankees, well, then there's some work to be done, because they certainly don't have the talent or the consistency to compete with those guys. Now, just real quick, I'm going to throw this out there. I think a large part of what they need is not necessarily more talent. It's more consistency. There's a reason I said it that way at the tail end of that. And I think a huge part of that is going to be what happens with Jeff Albert in year two. We obviously have no idea how to predict that, but I think that's going to be a focus this offseason in stories written about this team and in questions asked about this team. And it absolutely should be, because this is a team that was built to score runs, and like, midstream, they had to figure out how to be a run prevention team instead, because they weren't scoring any runs. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can get away with that for very long.
It's very interesting, the article that Mark Saxon wrote about Jeff Albert, a couple of days after the season, or maybe even during the NLCS. I can't remember exactly when it was written, but what we saw, just even the passing references in that, of people not necessarily still fully buying into what he has to do. Guys like Harrison Bader saying they weren't big on the analytics. Guys like Paul Goldschmidt and them saying, try to do a little bit and try to do what I can. But nobody seems to be, head over heels into what Albert is doing yet. And that may be because, there are some guys that have had success at the major league level and don't necessarily feel like they should adjust things. I think Harrison Bader might want to think about adjusting some things, but that's a different story. And it may be that Albert's, philosophy, one, takes a little time to get used to, but two, may not really be shown until they get guys up that maybe, maybe like Randy Orr's rated, maybe like Dylan Carlson, maybe guys that are coming up more open to that, because that's the way baseball is now, or they're younger guys that haven't got that track record, so they're willing to do anything to stay in the major leagues. Whatever the case may be, it may take some roster shakeup to get the most out of the Albert situation. We've seen that they've done that with the coaching staff. We saw Mark Badeska go. We saw George Greer go. We heard that they're going to do a lot of this in the minor leagues, replacing coaches that are more in line with what Albert is doing, so they could teach that stuff going up and down, which is the Cardinal way, if really. So, I mean, is that a possibility? I'm not saying that they're going to trade off Harrison Bader because he doesn't want to wear the little vest thing that measures how he swings. But I also think that it's a possibility that they'll look at their roster and say, this guy can or is willing to, adjust his game or to play on our playbook. This guy is less likely to, and, make a move if they need to.
Yeah, I do think that might come into play at some point. Although I want to be careful in how much we place on these players for the difference between maybe not understanding some of the analytics and not buying in the analytics. Those are two very, very different things. I think anyone who watches baseball, anyone who knows baseball, can look at the Astros and say, this is a team that's built on the foundation of being informed by analytics. Being informed by the data that you have in front of you doesn't fix your swing, right? It just gives you information from which to work. And I think in large part, this idea that there's this major chasm between guys who buy into analytics and guys who won't is, and again, some of this is an assumption on my part. Some of it is talking to guys in the minor league systems and how they're trying to implement it. But it's not so much that they won't accept analytics. Mm-hmm. Now, in some cases it is because they're grumpy old men, but in some cases it's just that, I mean, it's like if you were to be given instructions entirely in Japanese and then expected to know what to do with them. Like, some of them just don't understand what to do with those numbers that actually translate to what they're doing physically or mentally in the game. So the challenge for Jeff Albert and the staff that they're putting together is not necessarily to use numbers better, right? It's how do you translate those numbers to the players who actually have to do the hitting? And that's where there's, and I've been saying this for years, and I feel like a little bit of a broken record, because when they brought in Jeff Albert, I thought, okay, cool, this is a guy who understands hitters and he also understands data. Maybe he can bridge that gap. Evidently, it hasn't worked as smoothly as they hoped that it would, and they're convinced that they need some other personnel in place to help do that earlier on. But, you know, wearing a vest that shows your swing pattern, or, you know, the wearable tech that they have available to them, is only valuable if, when that data is generated, there's someone who can translate it. One of the last times I was in St. Louis, I actually got to, you know, see some of that data, see some of that tech in person. And when, you know, you throw a pitch and you suddenly see spin rate and you see gyro spin and you see all of this data, it's cool that all of that information exists, but I don't know what that means as far as what the pressure on my finger needs to be as I'm releasing. So if there's not somebody who can translate that, whether it's pitching or hitting, it's just a bunch of foreign language that these guys don't know what to do with. So that's why I would just at this point be a little hesitant to maybe like toss Harrison Bader out of the conversation because he doesn't like analytics, because maybe he doesn't. Maybe he just doesn't know what to do with that information. So someone needs to be able to work with him and bridge that gap. And hopefully that's what bringing kind of circling the wagons a bit and making sure that everyone involved in these conversations is on the same page about what that information means and how you can use it. That's, I think, when you'll start to see some of the changes that obviously made the Houston Astros a great hitting team. I mean, there's talent there as well, but they rely so heavily on how they make adjustments based on the information they have. And that has to be translated somewhere.
Yeah, and I don't know, I was, as you were talking about that, looking this up, trying to, because I couldn't remember his name, you know, when they hired the game planning coach last year, the Joey Prebinski. Now, he wasn't necessarily working with the players, but it was what go from analytics to the staff, and then the first staff would take it on to the players and things like that. You know, and I know this is, I've said before, this is kind of like turning around a luxury liner. You know, it doesn't happen automatically. This really does feel like another era in Cardinal baseball versus, you know, when Jocketty left and Lednow was there and they went and they, you know, kind of focused on the draft and getting all these players and homegrown players. And they were in the World Series in a couple of years, you know, this feels like, maybe not to have the same results necessarily, but it feels like that same kind of sea change for this organization. And it's going to take some time for it to flow all the way from top to bottom. So, yeah, I get that. I don't think that you do have to see, though, who is on board and who's not, because I think that's,
well, to some degree, who can apply it, right? Like, who can not just accept the information, but figure out how to do something with it? Mm-hmm. Because if you can say, oh, yeah, that makes sense, that's cool, I should do that more, and it still doesn't generate results, then the information isn't doing you a whole lot of good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And like I said, I don't know if that'll spur anything. I'm kind of feeling, and we'll talk, maybe we can use this to springboard into a little bit of what they might do in the postseason, but I'm kind of feeling like they're not going to do much at all, less because they don't feel like there needs to be something done. I'm just not sure that they feel like they can do a lot. They're kind of hemmed in with some contracts that's of their own making. They're hemmed in with a lot of possibilities, like a whole bunch of outfielders that they all should be playing in the major leagues that they can't seem to figure out how to do, which is also of their own making. I just, you know, the payroll is high for them, and I don't see them going out and spending a whole lot of money on other people. And I feel like they look at their team and they say, look, we got people at each position. We just got to figure out how to do it. And they may tinker on the edges. I just, you know, last offseason we were said, look, you know, Paul Goldschmidt, as soon as he found out he's available, they're going to push for him. They ought to be pushing for Bryce Harper. They ought to be looking at Manny Machado, all this stuff. I don't know that even the options are there this year, even if they were wanting to do something.
Yeah, it's definitely not a year where you have the Bryce Harper, Manny Machado kind of players available in free agency. And if you're looking for a piece to trade for, I mean, Mookie Betts has come up in conversation, but I don't know that the Cardinals can put together a package of guys they're willing to move that will inspire confidence in the Red Sox to move Mookie Betts at this point. Yeah, that would be fantastic. I think that, you know, it would be worth trying to figure out how you move people around and what positions you put people in for that addition. But I think it's important when we're talking about who they can trade. Yes, they have Lane Thomas and Randy Arozarena and Tyler O'Neill and, you know, even Harrison Bader. He may or may not be part of that mix. You have guys you can move. There's some young pitching you can move as well. And those pieces all exist, but they weren't good enough to play for the Cardinals full time. Why would other teams think they were going to be good enough to play for them full time? So there's, and that's not always the case, right? I mean, we see the Cardinals, you know, have traded guys in the past who weren't full-time players for them, and they went on to be full-time players somewhere else. And I think that it just is important to have some awareness of the fact that just because a guy exists in the organization doesn't mean that he's going to have value on the trade market, at least not to the level of a Mookie Betts or, you know, someone of that nature. So it is a little bit of a weird market as far as who they could go out and get. There are going to be guys available. There are going to be kind of like second tier players that we saw last year. The Cardinals kind of rumored to, not even rumored to be in on, but that could have made sense for them to pick up maybe a guy that's a little older, maybe a guy that's coming off of a down year, or, you know, isn't going to necessarily sign a long-term contract in free agency, but you could sign him for 1 year and see what happens, that kind of thing. I think they could do some good with that. The challenge is, do they have the people in place in the front office to find that guy, to find the diamond in the rough that's going to be a difference maker when the rest of the league thinks maybe he's not worth more than a 1 year contract or whatever it is? They've done it in the past. They just haven't done it in the recent past in being able to go out and find that guy. And I feel like they're not going to bring in a superstar. As much as we all like to talk about Gerrit Cole, they're not likely going to bring in Gerrit Cole. So what they need to do is find those guys who can pad their depth, who can give them the right kind of flexibility, not the kind of flexibility that just makes things more complicated, and use that sort of second tier player to their advantage, like they did really with Matt Wieters, but they haven't done with a guy like that otherwise in a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. It seems like there hasn't been a lot of that of late, and it's hard to understand that, you know, whether they'll do that again. And again, my thinking is they're going to look at a lot of these players and say, well, you know, it'd be nice to get Mike Moustakas, but we got to see what we got in Matt Carpenter, because if he bounces back, then we don't need Matt Moustakas. And we got to have a place for Tommy Edman to play, and, you know, so on and so forth. And I don't feel like they're willing to cut playing time or risk something on a guy like that when they have a chance to, you know, use internal options. And it's sad to think that, because there have been so many times over the last decade at least where the Cardinals could have gone out and improved themselves in a situation, well, like Gerrit Cole, you know, go out, you don't necessarily need pitching, but you can have a chance to go out and get a top-notch pitcher that just makes your team better. But they're not willing to do that. They're saying, well, we've got enough of pitching, we'll be fine. And it seems to always turn out that they don't. So I don't know. You're right. It feels like, you know, we kept talking last year about them making some sort of big move, some sort of, you know, culture changing thing to make this moment, to take this season ahead of it. They didn't do it. And it's really kind of hard to believe now until they do something. Because even the Paul Goldschmidt trade, while nice, was more of the same to some degree, a little bit of spare parts trading off, although Carson Kelly and Luke Weaver both did fine out in Arizona. I haven't seen a change in philosophy yet from them. And until they are able to do something that really shocks us, I don't know that anybody's going to expect them to do anything different. Doesn't mean they can't have a successful offseason, but I just don't see that it's going to be a dramatic one, even though maybe they could use it. Before we wrap it up tonight, I can't let this go without talking about the fact that the Cardinals got 6 Gold Glove nominations this week, and one of which was at second base.
About time.
I know. Well, you know, I'm done, and so I'm just going to let you go for the next 5 minutes. So Colton Wong with his first Gold Glove nomination, and seems unlikely, very likely he's going to win the thing. What do you think?
You know, I think we all know at this point the Gold Glove is a thing that's cool and it's nice to have and it's nice to say. It's not really the most telling of a guy's defensive dominance, especially when we talk about things like, I don't know, will his offensive stats be enough to get him noticed for the defensive award? It's kind of a silly thing all around, but it's a thing that, you know, matters to these players. And whether it's the most reliable explanation of what a guy does defensively or not, put that aside and recognize that this is, for Colton, I think a huge acknowledgement of what he's doing and what he's capable of. And it kind of just caps off the year that we've seen from him and the fact that a lot of people felt like this was the year for him to kind of step up into the moment and remind everybody what he is capable of, even if, you know, he, like most players in baseball, is a little bit streaky. So to see him on that list, to see him kind of reacting to it on social media a little bit is great. And I think more than anything, for a guy who's a confidence player like Colton, this is just going to help that. It's going to reinforce that what he's done has been noticed. It has been, you know, noticed beyond just St. Louis. And I think that'll only do good things for him going forward. So yeah, obviously pretty satisfied with Colton Wong finally getting his name on that list, even if it's not the most prestigious defensive award based on the reliability of its approach, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for a really significant, you know, who was the best, you're probably looking at the Fielding Bible or something like that. But, you know, the Gold Glove still has that kind of cachet. That's the kind of thing we measure by, and that's the kind of thing I'm not really sure the Fielding Bible puts a trophy on somebody's mantle either.
It's also the thing that the casual fan recognizes,
right?
So for Colton to have kind of permeated that part of the fan base, that part of the culture, that part of the baseball world, to where he's not just a hidden gem tucked away in St. Louis on teams that aren't very good, but he's a guy that has a Gold Glove, which means something more to maybe the casual fan that doesn't do the deep dive, and to the sort of surface baseball world, which is not, that's not a knock on those people or those fans, because, like, I get it, not everybody has time to care as much as we evidently do. But for him to have kind of bridged that gap to where people know Colton Wong, not just because that name sounds familiar, but because he's really good at defense as a Major League Baseball player, I think that is why it's significant, even if it's not in and of itself, you know, the deepest analysis of a guy's defensive ability.
Yeah, we'll take it. 5 other nominees: Molina, Flaherty, Goldschmidt, DeYoung, and Bader. I think Flaherty was the only one that was kind of a surprise, because I don't think we think about pitching Gold Gloves as much. Yeah. And I mean, Flaherty's been very good. He was a great pitcher this year, but I couldn't point to any really, you know, good defensive play that stood out. I mean, like I said, I'm sure he fielded his position fine and he didn't, you know, make mistakes very much. Maybe more on the base pass than he did fielding, but it was just a little bit surprising to see his name pop up.
Yeah, when I saw the number of awards that they were up for, I was counting, because I just saw the number without seeing the name. I was counting, and I was like, who is that last one? Oh, well, all right then, Jack Flaherty. No, I mean, it's great. I think, again, for Jack Flaherty, it was hard not for him to become a bit of a household name in the second half of the season, but for him to have reached that tier where he's recognized outside of just, I don't want to say just his pitching, but just the part of Jack Flaherty that St. Louis fans know, I think is, again, only going to be good for his confidence moving forward. And as a young guy to have that, even, you know, whatever merit he gives to that nomination, you know, I think it's a nice little check mark for him and a reward for the work that he put in this season.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, and we don't know. It could be that the other two guys got like 90% of the votes and Jack Flaherty got like 2, you know, and just enough to edge out everybody else, you know, to make that third spot. Who knows? We'll find out. But I did think it was pretty telling that the Cardinals, when they're announcing this with the little clips of defensive gems for all these players, noted Jack Flaherty with a strikeout. So
I mean, it's defense, right?
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, Molina gets the credit there, so... We'll take it. Whatever. It's nice to see the Cardinals, you know, again, for whatever Gold Glove's worth. Gold Gloves have been fairly tied to Cardinal history for the most part. I think, like I said, I'm pretty sure they have the most Gold Gloves in baseball, especially in the National League. You know, part of that's for having guys like Molina and Ozzie Smith and all those kind of guys that have won multiples. But to have, after last year's, you know, debacle, to have a lot of guys, you know, in their running for that, again, for whatever the Gold Gloves may mean, it is somewhat of a representation of how good the defense got after how bad it was last year.
And I think it's a little bit of recognition for at least part of the plan with Paul Goldschmidt coming to fruition, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for him to solidify that position at first base and to do so relatively quietly. It's not a position where you see a ton of web gems, but it is a position where... We know firsthand, if you don't have a quality glove there, it's going to cost you runs. It's going to cost you sanity, and you're not going to enjoy watching baseball as much. So to have him there, to have him once again as a Gold Glove caliber first baseman, sort of recalibrated the rest of that infield defense as well. Obviously, Paul Goldschmidt in and of himself does not make Colton Wong or Paul DeJong, who I think kind of faded down the stretch, may have just gotten tired from actually playing every single day, which is thing they're going to have to address next year.
He's going to have to train for 174, just like Yadier Molina.
Apparently he needs to train with Yadi this offseason, right, and go from there. But again, I think it's a nice nod to what Mike Schilt and company made a focus this year, which was something that we complained about a lot last year. So I'll take it. Thank you, Mike Schilt and company. But I also think that to some degree, it does reinforce the moves that the Cardinals made to shore up at least that side of the infield defense and then kind of play the hot hand to some degree at third base once Tommy Edman came up and see what happens from there. So as much as went wrong the last week of the season for the Cardinals, I think it's really valuable and significant to acknowledge how much went right defensively, and the Gold Gloves, at least the nominations for them, make that a baseball-wide knowledge as opposed to just in St. Louis.
And just think, you know, the Cardinals spent all offseason and spring training and all that working and improving the defense and the base running, and we saw the results. So if they could just do that for the offense this year.
But that much effort into the offense. But don't lose
them. Yeah. It's a building thing. You know, you've got that part. You get those achievements under your belt, so you could keep those, and then you can now work on the offense. Yeah. So hopefully that's the case. All right. Well, Tara and I will record probably infrequently during the off season, with Tara gets quite busy this time of year, and there's, you know, little less to talk about, especially if the Cardinals are not very active. I mean, you know, we're not going to talk about Bryce Harper every time this year. So we have less to talk about. So just follow us on Twitter. Like I said, I'm C70. That's Tara Wellen on Twitter. Follow us when the new show comes out. We'll have it there. Or you could subscribe. That would be really cool. Just subscribe to us on whatever podcasting thing you're using. And if you are subscribing, go ahead and rate and review us. That's excellent as well. But Tara and I will be back at some point in time. I'm sure we'll be back around the GM meetings and see what comes out of that. Maybe when John Mozeliak has his end of the year press conference, maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that as well. But until next time, whenever that may be, that's Tara and I'm Daniel. Good night.
Hey, Cardinals fans. Thanks for listening to this week's show. If you liked what you heard, you can find us on iTunes. Just search Gateway to Baseball Heaven under podcasts and click subscribe. While you're there, feel free to give us 5 of those little gold stars or even a quick review. And tune in next time as we break down another week in baseball heaven.